you on a subject I spoke on about a fortnight ago. I began talking about the 10 paramitas, or the 10 wholesome spiritual qualities which lead to strength of character, strength of mind, and the spiritual qualities which the Buddha before his enlightenment developed, and every future Buddha will have to develop before they are able to become enlightened. These 10 qualities of character are the qualities needed to become a Buddha. And before a person realizes Buddhahood, that person is called a Bodhisattva. And in each eon, in each period, there is only one Buddha who can arise in the world. And so for us, we're very fortunate to have been born in a period where a Buddha has arisen in the world. And for Buddhists, that is seen as bringing light to the world. For those who have eyes to see, those who want to also walk on a path to enlightenment, then now they have that path illuminated and they know the direction to go, because the Buddha, that is Buddha Gautama, pointed out a noble path, a way of practicing, which we too can apply ourselves and see, does it work? It's not a question of saying, yes, this must be true, but it's a question of applying it in your own life, seeing the results for yourself here and now, not to be delayed in time in some future point, future existence, or when you die. The Buddha's teachings of Dhamma is what leads inwards into your own mind, is to be known here and now, and it's to be seen by the wise, each for themselves. So these teachings are asking you to look inwards, asking you to go on a self-discovery, path of self-discovery. And I spoke about these spiritual characteristics, these spiritual qualities, which are needed for us in our spiritual path as well. Even though a Buddha has already arisen, we need to develop these particular qualities if we're going to get closer to enlightenment. Those spiritual qualities are 10 altogether. That is generosity, dana, virtue, sila, mekha kamma, renunciation, wirya, energy, panya, wisdom. And then there are the other 5 spiritual qualities which I want to talk about this evening and I didn't cover in my last talk, which is the spiritual qualities of kanti, which means patience or endurance, and the spiritual quality of satya, or truthfulness or integrity, the spiritual quality of adhidhana, or determination, and the spiritual quality of metta, loving kindness, and the spiritual quality of upekkha, equanimity. And so it's these last 5 of the 10 barometers which I will talk about this evening and try to make them and try to make them relevant to your lives and point out how they can be used. And the first one of these spiritual qualities is kanti, patience. We all know how important patience is, but particularly in the spiritual path. The Buddha said, kanti paramang tapodhi Pratita. There is no higher quality, higher spiritual quality for burning off unwholesome states as patient endurance. So if you want to know how to get enlightened really quickly, be very, very patient. That, the Buddha said, is the best way to burn off unwholesome states. Because in the Buddha's teachings, he said, the cause for our suffering has three roots, has three sources, and that is greed, hatred, and delusion. And it is through patient endurance that burns off these very three things. It burns off the tree of craving at the very root of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we notice in our own lives that sometimes if we just wait, we're just still, we're just patient, then things change, things improve, and we can endure. And sometimes we feel that we have very little patience. But that's just a perception of mind, isn't it? When I went to Thailand very early on and lived with Ajahn Chah, one of the subjects he always would go on and on about was enduring, to have a lot of patience, to endure in the spiritual life. And it was very difficult to be in a different climate, in a different culture, not speaking the language, to completely change your way of lifestyle, to be subjected to a different temperature, and to be bitten by mosquitoes and living on very coarse and hard food. That did take a lot of endurance. And sometimes I used to think in the early days that actually I had very little patience. And then one day when I was sitting in the meditation hall, we were doing one of these all-night sits, and we had to sit on a hard, we didn't have cushions like this, we had didn't even have the carpet, it was just a concrete floor. We had a thin piece of cloth on the concrete floor. And there was no fans, there was mosquitoes, it was very hot. And we had all our robes on. And I remember thinking that I'm not going to be able to endure this. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, I think. And then I just started to think, well, if I think I'm not going to be able to endure this tonight, I'm not going to be able to endure tonight. Why don't I just change my thinking? I think I've got an ocean of endurance. And as soon as I started to think, I have an ocean of endurance, then I had this resource there. Instead of thinking I had no endurance, which immediately meant a reaction to the situation, I started having this perception of mind, of having this ocean of endurance. And then I suddenly realized that this is often our problem. It's our perception of the situation, or our even perception of our ability to deal with the situation. Because this sense of self gets in the way. Actually, the enlightened mind does have an ocean of endurance there. The potential for infinite endurance is there. It's just our egos get in the way. We want it to hurry up. The difficult parts, the parts we don't like, we want to move along very quickly. The parts we're enjoying of life, we want to hang on to make them last, to not run out, keep going. We get frustrated when they do pass. And the difficult parts, we're in a desperate hurry to get over and done with, to get them out the way. But when we're going through difficulties, that's when we have to develop this perception that I have an ocean of endurance. I can endure this. So just now, if you're sitting here and you're feeling pain in the body, which all of us are feeling, some people have asked the monks, you seem to be able to sit so still. Don't you feel any pain? I assure you we do. But it's just that developing that perception, that cultivation of mind, that this too I can endure. This too I have an ocean of endurance for. And then we have that perception, then it doesn't matter what comes up. We can wait, be very patient. And it too will pass. Because to endure something, we have to have wisdom. We can have tenacity. That's one aspect of endurance. And a lot of people are very tenacious. They stick at things through stubbornness, maybe, or just tenacity or lack of wanting to give up. But that sort of endurance often comes from a sense of self as well, a sense of ego, a sense of pride. The sort of endurance we're developing on the spiritual path is the sort of endurance where the self gets out of the way. It's the patience and kanti, patient endurance that arises out of wisdom. The wisdom of the Buddha to know that this too will pass. This pain, this difficulty, this problem, this situation, whatever it is, will change. Therefore, I have an ocean of ability to wait. We have this perception that I too can wait and just be still, then we can watch the process change. And Ajahn Chah used to often give this simile that meditators are a bit like the person who's told that there's in these two sticks of wood, if you rub them together long enough, you can create fire. Now, if we tell this that to a person who's never seen fire, and they believe us, they may take the two sticks away and rub them intensely together. But after a while, they'll get tired. And when they get tired, then often frustration sets in, boredom, negativity, and then discouragement. And it's that discouragement that then leads them to throw the two sticks away into the forest, thinking there's no fire in those two sticks, those two pieces of wood. And then that person who has made fire before may come back and tell them again, no, I assure you, there is fire in those two sticks, those two pieces of wood. They may appear like wood now, but if you rub them intensely, continuously, and keep on going, not giving up, then if you do that evenly, persistently, you will get fire. And so the person goes searching in the jungle again for their two pieces of wood that they've thrown away, which have now cooled down. Then they bring them out again and start rubbing and rubbing and rubbing and rubbing and rubbing. Then after a while they get tired again. They get discouraged and they throw them away. And so they don't see the fire. But if we have this patience and this sense of endurance to carry on, to strive on, to continue when things get difficult, then success arises and we'll eventually see the fire that arises out of the rubbing of those two sticks of wood. And so too, it's the same with our meditation practice. When we are inspired in the beginning, we've had the person say, yes, if you practice, you too can enlighten your mind. Then we try, we put in a lot of effort. But it's when the frustration sets in, when the difficulties arise, when the problems and when the hindrances come up, they will arise. Be rest assured. But that's when we need this patience, this ocean of endurance. Just to wait, to let it pass, to let it change, and carry on. So that we're not tossing things away and then picking them up again, then tossing them away. And this is a very noble quality, a noble quality of character, a noble quality of mind. And in the Buddhist scriptures, this quality of patience and endurance, there's a very famous example of the Kanti Muni, who is called the Sage of Patience. And this sage once was living in a forest, practicing endurance. Patient endurance was his spiritual path. And he became very famous as the Sage of Patience. And one day, the king of that area decided to take his retinue out, take everyone out of the palace, and go to the park where this sage used to live. And he arrived at the park, and of course he had music, and he started drinking. And the king got drunker and drunker, and then he fell asleep. And while he's asleep, his wives and female attendants, because it was very rare in those days that they were allowed out of the palace, they decided they'd go for a walk in the park and go and explore the park. And they went over, and they eventually found the sage sitting meditation. And so they said to him, it is very rare that we get a chance to hear the Dhamma. Please give us some advice that would be useful for our spiritual practice. So he gave him a discourse about patient endurance. Be very patient, be very mild and mellow, and to endure the unendurable. And as he was giving the talk, the king woke up and asked his soldiers where his wife and female attendants had gone. And when he was told that they'd gone for a walk, he went into a rage because he was still under the influence of alcohol. And he raced off and he discovered the female attendants in the presence of the sage. And in those days, no man outside the palace was supposed to set eyes on them, the wives of the king. And so he asked the Sage of Patience, "Who are you?" And he said, I'm a sage practicing the quality of patience. And so the king drew his sword and said, "Oh, we'll see how patient you are," and then sliced off his hand. And the Sage of Patience's response was, "Venerable King, if you think patience is in my hand, you are mistaken." So he sliced up his ears, and without getting angry, he again repeated, "King, if you think patience is in my ears, you're mistaken." And then he continued to hack away at this sage, and each time he said the same thing. And just before the sage was about to die, one of the generals begged him, "Please do not curse the kingdom." And he said that, "I do not wish ill on anyone," and that is the practice of patience, the supreme practice of patience. So patience leads to great endurance, but it also leads to great loving kindness as well. And that is why you see that mothers will endure great problems and difficulties in bringing up a child, because they have this love, and that love brings great patience. Even when the child's clambering all over them, making a noise, waking up in the middle of the night, doing lots of normally annoying things, because of that loving kindness, that care, then they are very patient. Because these two qualities are interrelated. But I'll speak about loving kindness a bit later on. So that's an example, and it's also pointing out level of patient endurance that we can cultivate and aspire for. So you see, in Buddhism, there's no such thing as wrathful anger, which is righteous. Because anger is anger. It doesn't matter where it comes from. It is an unwholesome quality. The other quality of the spiritual qualities that are to be developed is the quality of satya, or truthfulness. And satya means integrity, or honesty, or truthfulness. And for all of us who have an interest in a spiritual path, what we're seeking really is ultimate truth. What is really true in this world? And to seek truth, we have to abide by truth. If we want the highest, we want what is true, then we have to come back to our daily life and always act according to satya, according to truth. That is, through honesty and integrity in our speech, in our behavior, and even in our thoughts, so that we're aspiring to that and directing our very actions, our very speech, to fulfill that qualities of ultimate truth. And satyam just means to commit yourself to that honesty and then fulfill that. And that leads to a great sense of inner confidence, a great sense of self-reassurance, you could say, where you are not afraid in situations because there's no deception there. I remember once traveling with a famous Thai monk from Thailand to Perth. His name was Thanachan Tui. And we landed, this was many, many years ago, and we landed at Perth Airport. And at that time, Buddhist monks weren't very known. And they'd had a recent drug scare at Perth Airport, which we found out only afterwards. And when we arrived, they decided to give a thorough going over of anyone who came from Thailand. And because we looked more unusual and than anyone else on the plane, they decided that they'd give us a special going over. And we were one of the first ones to get to the counters and the last people to leave the airport. And it took about 3.5 hours to get through the customs. And I remember they even took our robes and they felt through the borders and they took out our torches and everything they took apart. Torches completely apart, they squeezed all the toothpaste out and things like that. And it went on. And I was with this Thai monk and Ajahn Tui, who is a person who I have great respect for because he has a great devotion to discipline and honesty and truthfulness. And he couldn't speak any English, but he was getting me to translate to the customs inspectors, praising them all the time and saying, "Very good. We ought to have it like this. We ought to have it like this in Thailand. This is what I want to see. You know, honesty. Yes. Hey, you haven't inspected this." And then he'd pull out something else and get them to open that up and say, "And hang on, you've forgotten about this. Did you check that?" And he was making sure that they were being sure about everything they inspected. And in the end, the fellow started scratching his head because he couldn't figure out why we were double-checking that he was doing his job right. And I was having to translate through the whole process. And Ajahn Tui was praising him continuously for doing his job well, for doing it correctly, and doing what his duty, and also upholding honesty and truthfulness of all the travellers. And he says, "This is what I really respect." And then he said, "Go on, translate." I said, Ajahn Tui says, "He really respects what you're doing." This guy would look at us. And it was just that sense of confidence that comes from his integrity. And also, he knew that there was nothing to be found. He had nothing to be afraid of. So, if it takes 3 hours, that's okay. But do a good job. And he respected that, because he respected what needed to be done for the upholding of that integrity and truthfulness. And in society, that's why we have these laws, we have these standards, because these standards are what leads to harmony, and it leads to freedom from danger to oneself, freedom from danger to others, freedom from causing pain to oneself and pain to others, and difficulty to oneself, difficulty to society. So this question, quality of satya, is something that we stand by. And then this quality of satya, if you have this in your life, it actually becomes a protection. I have had many people come up to me my life as a monk, and they've had problems and difficulties, and they've come and asked me, can you give me something to protect me? And I've always pointed out this aspect of satya, that if you want to be protected, stand on integrity, and that will protect you. If you protect it, it will protect you. And we have a chant in Buddhism, which actually is a protection chant, where you do actually make a statement of your own integrity. And by the power of that, may I be protected, may other people be protected. And it's you may have heard the monks chant it, Natti me saranang anyang, Buddho me saranang warang, Ete na satya vajina, Soti te hotu sabada. Then it's repeated for Dhamma and Sangha. And that translates as, for myself, the Buddha, the Enlightened One, is my refuge. By the power of this statement, that I have no other refuge, by the power of this statement, may all of you be protected. And the truth is my refuge. I have no other refuge but truth. By the power of this statement, may all of you be protected. The Sangha, these Enlightened Ones, my refuge, my only refuge, by the power of this truth, that I have no other refuge, may all of you be protected. And this is actually a very, very powerful chant. I've used this in many difficult situations where my life has been threatened, or I have been in situations where it's hard to figure out what's going to happen. Some people may think, well, how can a monk's life be threatened? But it does happen. Not everyone finds monks endearing. Some people want to throw things at you. Some people want to abuse you. Some people even want to attack you because they don't like what you symbolize. And that has happened. And in those difficult situations, you can stand on this. Well, since I have been a Buddhist monk, I have tried never to intentionally kill any living being. I've never intentionally stolen anything. I've never intentionally done anything against any of the precepts. And by the power of that truth, may I be protected and may other people be protected. And so we can make these statements, these affirmations of truth. And that immediately, when you say that, it gives you this sense of confidence. And it can be very, very powerful. Because often fear is when we feel threatened and we have nothing to stand on, no refuge to go. But you can take refuge in your integrity, in your actions, and in your goodness, and in your sincerity, and in that truthfulness. What we can stand on. And when we cultivate that, it grows. And when we aspire to truth, and grow in truth, and incline in that direction, then our lives become truer. It becomes a life of integrity. The other spiritual quality that's important to develop is the quality of adhidhana. And adhidhana here means the quality of determination. When we take up any task, we have any goal in life, when we do anything, we have to have a degree of determination. And this goes together with our endurance, where we establish a goal and then we consistently and persistently put effort to fulfill that goal. And so we make a goal and then we try to fulfill and live up to that goal. This quality of adhidhana can be a two-edged sword. I'm sure many of you have experienced that, where you've maybe lit a candle or lit an incense stick and said, I'll sit meditation until the candle goes out. Or I'll sit meditation until the incense stick burns down. Or you set the alarm clock, I'll sit meditation for an hour. And then you find that candle seems to burn forever. That incense stick never seems to go out, or an hour seems to take 3 or 4 or 5. And then we get frustrated and we give up before it. And then we feel bad about ourselves. We feel negative because we haven't fulfilled that goal, that aspiration. So we actually have to be very, very careful about adhidhanas, because they are a two-edged sword. In our monastery, if we ever get a letter saying, Venerable Sirs, I like to come to your monastery to become a monk. The only thing I want to do is become a monk and become enlightened in this very lifetime. We know that that person never will turn up at the monastery. In all the 25 years I've been a monk, we've received many, many letters like that. Never once, even though we respond to them, send them all the information that we send to everybody else, the person who writes that letter, never once have they ever turned up at the monastery. Because as soon as they get the information of what's involved in becoming a monk, what's involved in coming enlightened, their adhidhana suddenly disappears. So we have to be very careful of setting our goals too high. As Ajahn Chah used to say, you have to know your cart and you have to know your horse. If you overload the cart, then it will break. If you do not know the strength of your horse, then you'll wear it out. So what we do is we start off with small determinations, small goals. Just begin by sitting half an hour a day, but do it regularly and try to keep that up. That's a goal, that's an aspiration, that's an adhidhana, a determination that we can keep. But also have a bit of wisdom with adhidhanas to know that yes, there will be some days when it's impossible to do that. But we'll try. We'll endeavor. And when that day comes that we have to put it aside, we'll pick it up again when the circumstances are right. Some people, once they break their adhidhana, their determination once, then they completely abandon the determination. So they make a determination, I'm going to sit meditation every day for half an hour in the morning. And then one day comes along when it's impossible, something comes up. And so the next day it says, well, it seems I've broken it one day, I might as well just give up that. And then they start back square one. So if things change, then use wisdom to know, oh, yes, impermanence has arisen. Now I re-establish my goal, my determination, to practice each day for at least half an hour. Then later on, once you've been able to do that, you may increase that to 40 minutes a day, to an hour a day. And then gradually increase until you do come to the monastery or to the nun's monastery and ordain. And then those sort of people usually stay. So those people who set too high goals, too early, too quickly, usually find they're setting themselves up for a fall. Ajahn Chah, I remember, once told this story, which happened when I was there. This man came along, and he carried his robes into the monastery. He came as a layman, but he had already bought a set of robes and a bowl. And he carried them into the monastery, and he bowed down to the Buddha image, put the robes to one side, and immediately started walking meditation out in front of the hall. And Ajahn Chah came past and said, what are you doing? And he said, I've come to ordain, but I want to get enlightened today. And Ajahn Chah said, oh, okay. And I think he lasted two days. I don't know what he did with his bowl and robes, but he just couldn't keep that up. There was no balance there, no wisdom. The wisdom faculty has to be there as well. To do things progressively, to do things one step at a time. But it is very important to make these adhikaranas, these resolutions. And that's why we have things like New Year's resolutions, isn't it? And I'm sure we've all made New Year's resolutions, or some of us have. And we find that actually it's easy to keep them for the first week or so, 2 weeks, month. But by December 2002, will we still be keeping that New Year's resolution? If we are, then that shows a great sense of determination, adhikarana. And that is one of those spiritual qualities. This sense of sticking at something, being persistent. And that's actually very, very important in meditation practice, in spiritual practice. Because it is not easy. We're dealing with our own minds, we're dealing with difficulties, we're dealing with sickness and ill health. Dealing with the ups and downs. And we need this sense of just sticking with it, carrying on. With time, you'll see the progress. But the Buddha said that enlightenment does not happen quickly, like the sinking of a ship. It's more a gradual inclination, like someone walking from the shore of the beach, getting into deeper and deeper water. The shore gradually inclines away. Enlightenment happens gradually, it happens progressively. So we need this gradual, progressive determination to grow and mature and stick with what we're doing. This ability to stay with what we're doing is very important. And the next spiritual quality of the Paramitas is metta, loving-kindness. And probably heard many talks on loving kindness since you've been coming to the Buddhist Society. But this is what we call one of the divine abidings. It's one of those qualities of mind which bring great happiness and great joy. It is the friendliness or goodwill, love to all beings. It's universal loving kindness. It is non-selective loving kindness. As a spiritual quality, we're developing the loving kindness, which is not just to those people who are close to us or we're related to or married to, not those people who we have preference for, but we're having universal loving kindness, non-selective goodwill, wishing all beings, wherever they are, whoever they are, in all situations, even those who we've had difficulties with in the past. We're having this goodwill, kindness towards them, and friendship. Seeing them in a positive light, opening the mind up. So we're opening the door of the heart to all beings, wishing them success, wishing them happiness, wishing them good health, wishing them enlightenment. Everything that is wholesome and positive in the world, may they obtain. And so loving kindness is this wholesome intention, sustaining a wholesome intention and keeping it there, an intention of goodwill. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. And to develop develop this quality of loving kindness, we often have to say the words in our minds. Repeat those words, because these words have meaning. And to get the feeling of loving kindness, we have to go to the meaning of the words. So we're repeating the words. Words like, I care for you. I care for you. And that word, to care, has a very profound and broad meaning, very deep meaning. So we're touching on to the meaning of the word. The word of friendship has a very profound meaning. Goodwill means to look at things and people in a positive way. And I always point out that you have to have goodwill to yourself. Loving kindness to yourself. This is actually where we start. If we have a dislike to ourselves, ill will, we're not wishing ourselves well, then we'll find it very difficult to have universal loving kindness to other beings. So we can direct this goodwill. Listen to your internal dialogue, your internal commentary. How do you talk to yourself? Do you criticize yourself constantly? Do we blame ourselves constantly? Are we finding fault with ourselves constantly? Are we abusing ourselves constantly? Are we swearing at ourselves constantly? And would you say that to your best friend, person, or the person you loved? And if you did, what would be the consequence? Of course they wouldn't react well. So why do we say it to ourselves? That's a good measure of whether we have goodwill to ourselves. It's how we speak to ourselves in the mind, that internal dialogue, that internal commentary. Do we wish, oh, may every cell in this body be healthy and well. May I be happy and well. May I obtain enlightenment. Obtain the highest. May I really be content. That is goodwill. That is loving kindness to oneself. And then once we have this gentleness, this gentle care, this gentle goodwill to oneself, we can spread that feeling out to other beings. And the benefits of loving kindness are 11. That is that one will sleep well, one will wake refreshed, one's complexion will be serene, one will have no evil dreams or nightmares, you will be liked by your fellow friends and have lots of friends. Even animals are drawn to oneself because of kindness. Heavenly beings, you may not see them, but they exist, will be drawn to you and protect you. You'll be free from dangers. Your meditation will be easy because you'll concentrate the mind easily because of the joy in the mind. You'll die unconfused. There'll be no fear. And if you have obtained a higher state, if you develop loving kindness to the point of going into an absorption, then when one passes away, one will be reborn in the highest heavenly realms, the Brahma realms. These benefits are many. But it's also, we can see that loving kindness directly overcomes anger and aversion. So that is one of the barometers. And the last barometer that I wanted to speak about, which is actually a very important one, and it's one I began with, is in the meditation session right at the beginning, I talked about developing this sense of equanimity, or balanced state of mind. And the last barometer of the 10 is equanimity. And equanimity is this quality of either delighting or having aversion in their mind. And equanimity is actually a very difficult quality to bring up and to develop. And someone actually asked me a few days ago, how do you meditate? How do you develop equanimity? The first way to develop equanimity is firstly to not allow the mind to go to like and dislike, because that's when the mind goes out of balance. When the mind goes to like, then that's going to desire. When it goes to dislike and aversion, then that's going to anger and negativity. So they're the two defilements in the mind, and then that brings up delusion. So we balance the mind by keeping the mind steady. The equanimity is the ability to be balanced in face of difficulties, in face of change. For example, when we get what we don't like, which will happen, or we are separated from what we like, which will happen, when we get what we don't want, when we experience old age, when we experience sickness, when we experience death, either our own or others, can we develop this sense of equanimity? Sense of balanced state of mind. The mind which is not driven by delight or by grief. Because if we're driven by delight and grief, then we'll always be blown off balance. We'll never have any peace of mind. The mind which is based in wisdom, because to stay in a state of equanimity takes a high degree of wisdom. A high degree of mindfulness to catch the mind when it's getting caught out by like, and when it's wandering off to dislike and indulging in dislike. To stop, bring the mind back, and center the mind, balance it, to stay equanimous. And we're going to experience difficulties in life of praise, blame, happiness, sorrow, fame and defame, good fortune and success and misfortune and loss. These qualities are going to arise. Can we stay balanced? Can we center the mind and take the good with the bad and just let it go? If we have a sense of wisdom that know that this too will change, yes, we may be going through a difficult period, but this too will change, then we can stay balanced, we can stay more equanimous, we can stay above the event, above the problem, above the difficulty, because we have the wisdom to know that this will arise and this will change. And so the mind does not get upset and doesn't get delighted. And because sometimes those difficult circumstances end up being fortuitous. If we didn't have this suffering in our life, we'd probably never become interested in the spiritual path. There's these difficulties and these problems make us look a bit deeper, look beyond the surface and look deeper into things. There's that legend, that story about the farmer and his son. The farmer's very poor, and he has a wife and one son, and they're having a great struggle making a livelihood, and he was complaining that, you know, his life is miserable, his life is hopeless, and he's feeling very depressed. And then one day the great landowner in the district, his thoroughbred horse escaped and came onto the poor peasant's property just as when he was thinking his life is miserable, life is hopeless. And the son captured the thoroughbred horse, and the great landowner came and saw the horse had been caught and was was so delighted he decided to reward the peasant family. And so when they caught the horse, of course, the farmer was delighted. This is wonderful. This is good fortune. And then when he was rewarded, he was given a mare. He thought, oh, it's wonderful. Now I can breed this mare and make a stable, and then I'll be successful and I won't live in poverty anymore and my family will be healthy and well. This is wonderful. But one day the son was riding a mare and he fell off and broke his leg. Broke his horse, broke his leg. And he broke his leg, and then the farmer thought, this is terrible. This is misfortune. This horse has brought me great misfortune. I wish this had never happened. And then a little while later, that area, they were going to go to war. So the landowners were looking for soldiers. So they came to the property to conscript the son and said there's going to be a war. But when they saw he had a broken leg, they said, oh, well, you're exempt, of course. And so the farmer said, oh, it's wonderful, you've broken your leg. You got out of conscription. This is marvelous. But then after the conscription had passed, the son's leg didn't repair. And so he couldn't do any work in the fields, and the farmer had to work harder, and he's saying, well, it's terrible that you've got a broken leg, then you can't work and earn your living. And of course, this story goes on and on like this. You can get the general theme that what happens sometimes is seen as good fortune ends up becoming not so beneficial in other circumstances when it changes. And then those things that seem like misfortune change into good fortune. And I'm sure all of us have experienced that. So we have to be very careful not to always believe the misfortunes as being that. But sometimes there is a silver lining in there. Especially if we approach that misfortune to develop wisdom. So whenever difficulties and problems arise, use that difficulty and problem in life to look and deal with it with wisdom. Stay more balanced. Stay more focused. Today, just before coming here, I went to do a funeral for a person who's had a long association with the Buddhist Society. He wasn't a Buddhist, but his wife was, and he has given a lot of help to the Buddhist Society over the years. And I went as a part of the funeral service, and it was a Catholic funeral service, and I was also attending. And at the end of the service, there was the famous lines of taking the sand, pouring it on the coffin, saying, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And that's it, isn't it? There's not much else to say after. All our likes, all our dislikes, all our desires, all our aversions, all our wants, all our searching, all our building, all our creating, is just that. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We can't take any of it with us. It's just that. And so when we start to use these things, these truths as reminders, then wisdom starts to arise and we can start to let go of the clinging, let go of the craving and develop more equanimity. And when I came back here tonight, I was in my room and Venerable Nyanatustha came and knocked on my door and said, oh, your sister's on the phone. She said it's urgent. Normally my sister doesn't ring up very often. So if she says it's urgent, it's usually urgent. So I thought, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And I prepared myself before going out. I thought, okay, if she's on the phone, that she obviously hasn't died. But maybe somebody else has. So who do I know that could have possibly died? I just use this reflection, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. Can I stop that from happening? And just centered the mind in equanimity and went out. And it was true, one of my relatives had passed away. And it's just by establishing the mind in equanimity, then you can deal with the situation very skillfully. But if you go to that situation and think, it shouldn't happen, why is it like that? I don't want it to happen. Please don't happen. Then that's when confusion, that's when doubt, that's when all the pain and grief arises. We know this will happen to every one of us. And so when you go to a cemetery next time, go and look for the grave that's waiting there for your name. It will happen. So prepare the mind. If you never prepare the mind, then you'll be under the influence of fear. It's when you prepare the mind, then the mind becomes very steady, very stable, and very peaceful. Whatever happens, we're ready. So these qualities that I've spoken to you about, the 10 spiritual qualities, these qualities are leading to this very thing, to the deathless. The Buddha, in his enlightenment, wanted to discover something which didn't die, that didn't change. When he became enlightened, he saw and discovered that very thing, that is Nibbana, enlightenment. And when he saw and discovered that very thing, he knew there is a pathway to the deathless. So he taught that pathway. He taught that the spiritual qualities and the Noble Eightfold Path are the qualities which will lead to the deathless. So if you see your gravestone, Karakata or Fremantle, that's okay. If you've walked the path to the deathless, it doesn't matter.